Taken under advisement, we move to the fourth case this morning, Timmons versus General Motors Corporation. Ready for you.
I apologize. I think you got a little ahead of yourselves today.
May it please the court, my name is Mark Dabowski. I represent the appellant, Doc Timmons, in this case. The issue in this case is relatively simple. The issue in this case is whether Doc Timmons was capable of driving a car. And the answer is yes. The examination that General Motors conducted was not specific enough to test whether Mr. Timmons was capable of driving. Therefore, there is at least a genuine issue of material fact as to whether Mr. Timmons was qualified, and there is at least a genuine issue of material fact as to whether Mr. Timmons posed a direct threat to himself or to others by driving a car. The problem with the examination that General Motors conducted in this case is that without a specific evaluation of Mr. Timmons' ability to drive a car, the examination was neither job-related, as the statute requires, or consistent with business necessity. In fact, the defect in Dr. Lacey's examination is the same defect that this court found in the case of Ammons versus Aramark, where the court held that the expert's report was unreliable when the expert had never observed the duty in question that was being considered under the ADA case. We specifically asked Dr. Lacey in his deposition whether he had observed Mr. Timmons driving a car. His answer was negative. We specifically asked Dr. Lacey whether Mr. Timmons was tested, because we identified at least three facilities in the Chicago area that could have tested Mr. Timmons' driving ability. And none of those facilities were consulted in the case, even though the prior year, when General Motors allegedly had concern about Mr. Timmons' ability to drive, such an evaluation had been considered. There are three cases that we relied on heavily with respect to the point that we wanted to make about the failure to examine the specific duty in question means that the examination that was conducted is insufficient and does not show that the individual in question was not qualified to perform the job. In Holiday versus City of Chattanooga, Lowe versus Alabama Power, and Gillen versus Fallon Ambulance, the 1st, 6th, and 11th circuits ruled that the failure to test the specific duty in question invalidated the employment decision.
What were those duties that were not examined?
In the Holiday case, the issue was whether the police officer's HIV positive status would affect his ability to work as a police officer.
Did any of them have to do with driving?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
The Gillen case is the closest, and that has to do with an emergency medical technician and had to do with lifting ability.
But driving, you found none on driving.
The only cases that we were able to find in our research that involved driving were all cases where the individual in question failed to meet the standards required by the Department of Transportation.
Mm.
In this case, Mr. Timmons was not disqualified under DOT standards. Moreover, he was qualified even under Dr. Lacey's findings within the standards of the Illinois Administrative Code with respect to the Secretary of State's driving standards, both with respect to his vision, his ability to turn his head, as well as his ability to use his right side, which was unaffected by the MS, in order to be able to drive a vehicle.
Did Dr. Lacey's examination address the issue of accommodations at all?
Not at all, Your Honor. And that's another significant defect with respect to what General Motors did in this case. If Dr. Lacey had concluded that Mr. Timmons was not capable of driving, it then became General Motors' duty to consider whether there might be accommodations that would have enabled him to perform his job, such as the installation of hand controls in his car. That was never considered. Instead, Mr. Timmons was immediately relieved of his duties and placed on disability without any further consideration. There is also a genuine issue of material fact as to whether Mr. Timmons posed a direct threat either to himself or to others. Under this court's decision in Branham versus Snow, it is a very fact-intensive examination. And since there was a genuine issue of disputed fact with respect to whether Mr. Timmons posed a direct threat, then it cannot be said that Mr. Timmons posed a direct threat as a matter of law. The Chevron case is the leading Supreme Court authority on the direct threat doctrine. The Chevron case relies both on the ADA statute as well as on the regulations. And the regulations explicitly require, and this is 29 CFR section 1630.2R, an individualized assessment of the individual's present ability to safely perform the essential functions of the job. There must be an examination of the best available objective evidence. The best available objective evidence in this case would have involved something far less intrusive than a medical examination. It would have involved a road test to see if Mr. Timmons could drive. The other issues that are raised are simply red herrings, because the only issue that led to Mr. Timmons being relieved of his duty was whether he could safely drive after Dr. Lacey's examination. And because a logical bridge cannot be drawn between Dr. Lacey's examination results and a conclusive finding that Mr. Timmons was unsafe to drive, then the court's grant of summary judgment in this case was in error. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Bosky. Mr. Vogel.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. I respectfully disagree with plaintiff's counsel to the extent that he asserts that the sole issue is whether Mr. Timmons, the plaintiff in this case, could safely drive a car, which all the parties concede was an essential function of his job in this case. The issue, as we interpret the cases, a lot of them being district court cases, but cases out of the circuit, is whether Dr. Lacey's finding, concluding that it was not safe for him to drive, was made in a way that was reasonable and in good faith. As we read a lot of this case, one of the key elements of plaintiff's case and the gist of plaintiff's case to some extent was that it's in paragraph 19 of the complaint that was originally filed, is that plaintiff's personal physician agreed that he could drive, while it was a GM doctor who stated he couldn't drive. I think it's important to point out for purposes of this record, which I realize wasn't addressed by appellant's counsel here, is it's also very clear from the record that the opinion of plaintiff's personal physician at the time of Dr. Lacey's examination, which was June of 2003, was not shared with GM. In fact, the plaintiff made the conscious, deliberate decision to prohibit GM from speaking with his personal physicians. And I know you're all familiar with the facts, But the plaintiff has multiple sclerosis. That's uncontested. It has grown gradually worse over the 11 years since he's been the 11 years prior to this incident that he was diagnosed with that. GM had some concerns based on their personal observations of Mr. Timmons as to whether he could safely perform the function of driving. And I'm paraphrasing here to some extent and trying to zip through this, but they approached him to discuss those concerns, and the conclusion was reached, we should talk to your personal physician. Mr. Timmons wrote up his own authorization stating, you know, I hereby authorize you to share records and speak with GM regarding this issue. And then, before GM could speak with the doctor, Mr. Timmons withdrew that authorization.
Did any of his personal physician's opinion get into the record?
Yes, I think that's important, Your Honor, in two contexts it got into the record, that both of which I think are relevant to analyzing the way in which GM made the decision that it did. There was an assertion of plaintiff's qualifications to drive made by his personal physician, and I think the record's a little squirrely on this, but in September of 2002, there was some communication between plaintiff's personal physician and GM stating that he could safely drive. This is... do the math in my head there. This is 10 months after that, June of 2003, when GM conducts its examination. Later, in fact, after this litigation had commenced in April of 2004, after the lawsuit had been filed, plaintiff's personal physician came forward with an affidavit, and I apologize, I'm a little off on the record in terms of this, whether it was September of 2004 or December of 2004, but in any event, it was 8 to 12 months after the litigation had been filed. I apologize, 5 to 8 months after the litigation had been filed, and well more than a year after Dr. Lacey, the GM doctor, had conducted the examination, stating that he didn't believe he was safe to drive. So at the crucial time, which I think it's important to note that that's what the district court was looking at, June of 2003, there was silence from plaintiff's personal physicians. And essentially what the plaintiff said on that issue in the lower court was, GM shouldn't have asked any questions once it had the September 2002 statement that he could drive safely. It ignores the fact that several months had passed between September 2002 and June 2003 and what had happened. And I want to be careful not to concede anything, but there may be some back and forth in the record as to what happened between September 2002 and June of 2003. But what is uncontested is that prior to June 2003 and after September 2002, plaintiff had an accident in a motorized scooter in which he basically fell over on his scooter, and that was observed by GM. And at that point, that fact alone gave GM some concern about whether it was safe for him to drive. There were some other allegations as to whether he was falling asleep while working, et cetera, et cetera. But it seems a little... melodramatic to say GM had no choice, but GM had concerns, and I think the case law is very solid that if you have some concerns about a safety issue, you have a right to address that. They did try to go through his personal physician. He refused to let GM speak to his personal physician, and at that point, they had their medical director do it. And I think the issue is not necessarily whether Dr. Lacey was right when he reached his conclusion as to whether or not it was safe for the plaintiff to drive. The question is, was that decision made in a reasonable manner, and was it made in good faith? And we would submit there's no evidence that that decision was not made in a reasonable, good faith manner.
Well, that doesn't end the inquiry, though, counsel. Isn't it undisputed that Dr. Lacey did not consider the issue of accommodations, and neither did GM before putting the plaintiff on disability leave?
I think there's a couple of ways to respond to that, Your Honor. The first point that I would raise as a procedural matter is this is not a failure to accommodate case. If you read...
Well, it's an ADA claim, right?
That's correct, Your Honor, but the question...
And one way to violate the ADA is failure to accommodate.
Absolutely, Your Honor. But if you look at the complaint and if you look at the plaintiff's opposition to summary judgment, both of which I reread again last night to be clear on this fact, nowhere in either of those documents does the plaintiff assert that GM did not consider or did not offer a reasonable accommodation, and that is where they violated the ADA. What the plaintiff says is, I could drive safely. He does not say he needed any sort of accommodation. He says, I was a fine driver. I was doing my job just fine. I should have been left in that job. They should have left me alone. Period.
Well, he was claiming to be a qualified person with a disability under the statute, and part of that determination is the question of accommodations. The question of reasonable accommodations also comes in as the affirmative defense, or on the affirmative defense, should it be offered.
On the direct threat, Your Honor?
Well, that reasonable accommodations are impractical or would impose an undue hardship, but the concept of accommodations also is part of the definitional term about whether the plaintiff is a qualified person with a disability, and that was part of his claim, wasn't it?
No. Was that boilerplate language in some of his documentation as to the definition and that sort of thing? Absolutely. But when, as the case proceeds through litigation and he has to frame his claim, he doesn't say, and by the way, here's the accommodation I should have been offered, or they failed to consider an accommodation. That's nowhere in the complaint. That's nowhere in the summary judgment briefing. Now, a note in the record, there is uncontroverted evidence that GM did discuss with him various other alternative job opportunities, granted before it came to pass that he ended up on a disability leave of absence in June of 2003. There were discussions of other alternative positions that would not have involved a decrease in his employment level or his salary. They just would have limited the time in which he had to drive or travel, and he rejected both of those offers. Also, I would suggest, and I realize this doesn't always sound as good as it should in terms of an employer arguing against a disability claim, but one of the accommodations specifically listed in regulations are paid leaves of absence, which is exactly what he ended up on in terms of this. The accommodation that I believe is discussed somewhat in the briefing before you is an issue of hand controls. Was it possible that he could operate the car with hand controls?
Special mirrors, too, I think were mentioned.
Special mirrors, I believe, were mentioned for the first time in the doctor's deposition, as it's listed almost in passing, as he notes. And I do think the specifics of this are somewhat relevant. One of Dr. Lacey's findings was that Mr. Timmons had some significant restriction in lateral flexion of his neck. Layperson's terms, he couldn't turn his neck as much as an average person could, and that would hinder his ability to drive because he couldn't check blind spot and turn, etc. What his own doctor said in response to some questions was, I've never looked at that. I don't know what his limitations are one way or another in terms of his neck. And I believe the question was, could that possibly restrict his ability to drive? He said it could. I know there's some patients who drive with mirrors, and that sort of thing can happen. Again, that was never raised in the pleadings, in the lower court briefing, or as these events came to pass, as these things happened. Again, the reasonableness and the good faith of the doctor is demonstrated. He's board certified in occupational environmental medicine for 30 years. He's been conducting work-related evaluations for GM employees for 25 years. He found a litany of problems, which I don't believe are truly disputed by the plaintiff. Problems with his vision, problems with his gripping, again, the problems with the neck and that sort of thing. There's some language, in fact, on page 7 of the appellant's reply brief, where he references an inherent bias, or the bias inherent in having a company physician conduct these kinds of examinations. I think it's clear from cases within this circuit that that's just simply not something that's recognized as a matter of law. Employers have a right to rely on their own personal physicians. There is the one EEOC regulation that states, basically, you should be careful if your company physician says one thing and the employee's personal physician says something in contrast to that. You should be careful, is what they say. It doesn't say you can't choose one or the other. And I think the importance in that is, as the district court pointed out, GM didn't have that conflict because Mr. Timmons admittedly wouldn't let them talk to his doctor. I mean, I think, Your Honor, with your question about reasonable accommodations, a lot of the cases talk about the interactive process. And if we're going to fault GM for not raising these issues, which perhaps it's appropriate to do, I think we also have to fault Mr. Timmons for saying, any sort of dialogue between the company and my doctor, I'm just not going to allow that to take place. And I'm going to sit, and I'm going to file a lawsuit, and then 5 months later, I'm going to have my doctor come forward and say, by the way, if If I'd have said anything in June of 03, it would have been that you were okay to drive. I don't think that's fair play. I mean, it wouldn't work in this forum to withhold evidence like that or an opinion like that and then try to use it down the road. Just don't think that's fair. Just addressing briefly, there was some other evidence which the plaintiff suggested showed that the examination wasn't reasonable and in good faith. He indicates there was a private conference between the doctor and the supervisor. Again, plaintiff acknowledged in his deposition he doesn't know what was said in that conference. The participants in that discussion said, well, the supervisor gave me a job description and said he had some concern about his ability to drive. Anything else on that would be speculation. I do want to touch on the plaintiff's point about the belief that he has to be subjected to a driving test in order for this examination to be reasonable and good faith. We also have not been able to find any case in which any court has found that. In fact, the cases, the Munt case, for example, out of the Northern District, and I believe the Bay case out of this court, indicated that there were other ways you could conclude that someone was not able to drive short of putting them in a car and watching them drive and perhaps watching them fail and that sort of thing. Again, the issue here is to disability discrimination. The way we would respectfully suggest that the case was framed before the court was GM's decision to place Mr. Timmons on a paid disability leave because of its belief that he could not drive, was that a pretext for wrongful disability discrimination? And I think to get to that, under any of the tests that are used, and there's some back and forth in the briefing about whether the Lawson case should apply or the Rooney case and its analysis is similarly situated, I think regardless of which of those tests are used, the question becomes, did GM truly have a concern about Mr. Timmons' ability to drive? And I think it's uncontroverted that they did. Did the doctor conduct an examination of him that was reasonable and in good faith? Again, I think it's absolutely correct that he did. And were those decisions based on some sort of stereotypes of individuals who had multiple sclerosis? They were not. The GM's observations were based on the accident in the scooter, some reports of him falling asleep at work, and some observations of erratic and slow driving on the highways. The doctor's examination was based on observation of visual acuity, ability to turn neck, ability to grip, ability to use his legs. And we would respectfully suggest that with the issue of the alleged failure to accommodate, consider an accommodation, that was not properly preserved in the lower court. If there aren't any additional questions, I'll step down. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Very briefly, the issue here is not an issue of whether Dr. Lacey had a subjective good faith belief that Mr. Timmons was incapable of driving. As the Supreme Court taught in Bragdon versus Abbott, and I quote, courts need not defer to an individual doctor's opinion that is neither based on the individualized inquiry mandated by the ADA nor supported by objective, scientific, and medical evidence.
Isn't the question whether the company had subjective good reason to believe that they were nervous about his driving?
I don't believe so. I think
the doctor's opinion is part of it, but I mean, whether he's right or wrong, once they hear the information and together with the other information they have, isn't it their good faith that we're talking about?
I think that that's sort of putting the cart before the horse.
Why?
We're not disputing that GM may have had a subjective, reasonable, good faith belief that Mr. Timmons may have had difficulty with driving.
No.
But the way that they
did unqualified to drive their vehicles on their terms at their job.
But under the ADA, it's not their reasonable belief that he's incapable of driving. The ADA mandates objective evidence. Dr. Lacey's report.
So we're talking about the objective evidence. He fell from the scooter. He fell asleep at the job. He slept at the job. The medical things, these are all part of it.
I'll address all of those.
Do it.
The falling asleep on the job occurred in 2002. It had to do with a adjustment in Mr. Timmons' medication. He never fell asleep on the job again after that. GM had spoken to both of Mr. Timmons' doctors after that occurred, Dr. Yang.
When was he taken off the job?
He was taken off the job in June 18, 2003.
Hmm.
Falling asleep occurred in the fall of early fall 2002.
Hmm.
Both of the doctors were consulted at that time. Mr. Timmons gave ongoing authorizations to consult with his doctors from mid-2002 through May 2003. He gave his last authorization and didn't revoke it again until June. With respect to the scooter incident, GM tries to assert that that's evidence that Mr. Timmons lost control and could not control a vehicle. Mr. Timmons hit a pothole in a dark parking lot in February of 2003. This examination took place in June of 2003. There is no indication, even in the evidence relating to the scooter incident, that Mr. Timmons lost control. And Mr. Swinson, the supervisor, admitted as such at pages 55 and 56 of his deposition.
The disease we're discussing is one that is, as it goes on, it gets worse. That is, it becomes more debilitating as you proceed in time. Am I correct?
There are two kinds of MS.
Yes.
Dr. Frank, the treating neurologist, described both kinds.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Timmons was initially diagnosed with what's known as relapsing remitting multiple
mm-hmm.
sclerosis,
mm-hmm.
which then developed into progressive multiple
mm-hmm.
sclerosis. There's no question that it was worsening at the time that Mr. Timmons...
So his diagnosis is progressive MS.
Correct. And there would have come...
As time goes by, he gets less and less able to do the things ordinary people can do.
Not for everybody, necessarily.
No, I said progressive.
But the point is that at the time that GM made the decision, they did not have the objective evidence that the ADA required before they relieved him of his job duties and put him on disability. The ADA explicitly requires an individualized assessment using the best available objective evidence. They failed to do that. For that reason, there is, as I said before, at least a genuine issue of material fact that should lead this court to reverse the court below and remand the case for trial. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Boskin. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under